John Kitchen, and welcome to our Out the Coup Extra with Jamie Long-Gazelle, Associate Professor of Political Science at John Jay College in New York City. Jamie is the author of Undocumented Fears, Immigration, and the Politics of Divide and Conquer in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And on today's program, we're going to be talking about former Hazleton Mayor and United States Senate candidate Lou Barletta. Jamie, thank you for joining us today for our interview extra.
Thank you for having me.
So we have Lou Barletta. He is running for Senate. He's congressman in my area. He is not my congressman. Scott Perry is. But, you know, for today's extra, we want to talk about Lou Barletta and his use of going after undocumented immigrants for his rise in politics over the past 15, 20 years. But before we do that, I just want to give a quick of the Hazleton region and the racial dynamics, maybe going back into the, you know, 1800s. We met a couple years ago at a Put People First convention in Philadelphia. You gave a really nice talk about that region in general. And one of the things that we started off, you started off your talk with was the Latimer Mine Massacre, which anniversary was yesterday on September 10th. So you just want to walk us through that process?
Yeah. And it's important to start there because the what's happened in Hazleton in recent years and what Lou Barletta has been doing in as a congressman is in a lot of ways a repeat of what happened in the past. And so there are lessons out there for us to learn and understand what's going on. Hazleton is part of the anthracite coal region in Pennsylvania and has this, you know, long and rich history of conflict between labor and capital in the coal mining industry. And, you know, there's strikes and turmoil and the list goes on. And yeah, the Latimer Massacre, the events in 1997, the culmination of a large strike brought about the coal bosses wanted the miners to work more hours without extra pay for those hours. And they protested and the strike got very big. Upwards of 10,000 miners were participating in it. And they managed to shut all but one colliery down. And the final one was the Latimer colliery. And so they planned a march to go to that colliery and try to get those workers to come off the job too. And the coal barons of the day recognized the threat of this. And part of what they were so threatened by was this idea that people had come together, that the more settled English-speaking immigrants and the more recent Slavic and Italian immigrants had sort of set out past exclusionary stuff that was happening within the union and other things like that. And they came together in solidarity and were successfully carrying out this strike. The coal barons leading up to the massacre had held a private meeting behind the scenes. And all we know about that meeting is that there were 300 Winchester rifles delivered to those offices, and the coal barons hired they reached out to the the local sheriff, who hired a posse of deputies, 90 members of this posse. And it was there where they met the striking miners, who were all unarmed, and eventually opened fire on them, killing 19, injuring dozens. Many had bullet holes in their back because they were retreating. There were reports of ethnic slurs being shouted as members of the posse kicked people while they were laying and bleeding. You know, it's this really remarkable story that is filled with ethnic animosity and these divisions that happened. And you know, it's tragic, but it's also powerful because it teaches us the importance of coming together and how powerful we can be when we do.
And the so the formation, this massacre played an important role in the formation of United Mine Workers Association. Am I not correct with that? This was a pivotal moment in that union's or that the formation of that union's history.
Yeah, well, one of the things sort of carried, you know, too, when the Great Strike of 1902 happens, and that becomes even just beyond the union, that becomes significant for the entire labor movement. That's when, you know, the president had to intervene and the Department of Labor was established and those sorts of things. And so yeah, it was it kind of in the way that the story gets told, we get the massacre and then a couple of days after But yeah, it's a much bigger picture in the broader labor movement. And, you know, Hazleton and the coal region specifically has this rich history of labor that I think we've unfortunately forgot. And I don't know, we, the people, have rather the folks who wanted us to forget, who have encouraged us to forget, who've taught us to point our fingers at more recent immigrants rather than at the forces that are actually keeping us down.
Mm-hmm. And then I know going off to the 1950s and the 60s, I recall you saying that Hazleton had this can-do moment, and then up. Would you mind just touching upon that, jumping forward to that part of the history?
Yeah. So, you know, coal starts to go under in the early 20th century. And then by 1950s, it was just about all the way down. In fact, there was a moment in the 50s where there was a flood and Hazleton's coal mining jobs got down to zero. Unemployment was at like 25%. And so this group, this organization called CanDo, is formed mostly by local elites and business owners, but it was a pretty grassroots kind of effort. Lots of people were involved in the fundraising campaigns and so on. And what they were able to do was raise $2 million, buy a whole bunch of land that they used. And with that, Hazleton essentially switched over from a coal economy into a manufacturing economy, which lasts for several decades and which allows people, you know, I don't want to idealize it, but it allows people to live a relatively comfortable lifestyle through the 60s, 70s, into the 80s. The 80s are a key moment, though, for Hazleton, as they are for many places. Once the Reagan administration comes in and starts cutting funding for community development, groups like CanDo start to really struggle because they're not getting the help that they need from the government, and they end up competing with one another over trying to attract jobs into these areas. And so from that point forward, CanDo really starts to take a different approach that culminates in the late 90s with this Keystone Opportunity Zone initiative, which is a statewide thing that CanDo really relied on. Luzerne County in Hazleton actually had the most KOZ land of any county. And that's what Hazleton, once the KOZ initiative comes, and KOZ is there to provide companies who agree to open up on certain parcels of land that have been deemed to be blighted, they get tax breaks for opening up on that land, in some cases for up to a dozen years. In some cases, it's a full moratorium, zero taxes for opening up shop on these parcels of land. So CanDo turns to this in the late 90s, and that flips Hazleton, its economy and its demographics, in a big way.
Mm-hmm. And then when does Lou Barletta start factoring this? When does he become mayor of Hazleton? And when do we, like, and how do these demographic changes start to play out?
Yeah, so he, you know, these demographics, it happens kind of slowly, and I don't think a lot of people were recognizing that KOZ was going to bring about the kind of changes that it did. I think they should have. I think there was a lot of evidence out there that a meatpacking plant comes in. I think there should have been expectation that things were going to change. Lou Barletta, in fact, signed off on the KOZ initiative. He was in favor of that and gave CanDo his blessing, which I think is ironic given what happened and what he did. You know, the change happens. So from about 2000 until 2006, the population change is dramatic. At the 2000 census, Hazleton's population was 95% white. And then in 2006, the estimate was that about 36% of the city's population identified as Hispanic or Latino. And so you had this really quick shift, and at the same time you had increasing poverty, right? Like manufacturing jobs, Luzerne County lost more than half of its manufacturing jobs from 1980 until 2000. And so you have poverty coupled with changing demographics, and no one really had a great explanation for why this was going on, because you didn't have a lot of the community leaders talking about these economic issues. And so what Barletta does is he comes in 2006, at that point he's mayor, and he starts to scapegoat immigrants, and he takes advantage of a homicide that is allegedly committed by two undocumented Latino men against a white Hazleton resident. These men were importantly never convicted of this crime. They were accused of it. They were the suspects, but the case was dropped due to lack of evidence. And so they were never formally convicted. Nevertheless, Barletta runs with this. He uses this to create a panic in Hazleton to create this image that undocumented immigrants are inherently crime prone, are running rampant through the city, are inherently resource draining, are burdening Hazleton financially. He uses this, and it becomes this explanation for why Hazleton is struggling. And you know, this is the essence of Trump's politics in a lot of ways too. It works because there is an element of truth in that people are struggling. People are living in these places that are going downhill economically. And so it's tapping into that fear, I think, but it's also tapping into racial resentment and racism. And it's taking those fears and giving them a different outlet and encouraging people to take their economic anxiety and use it toward blaming immigrants. And so that turns out to be wildly successful for Barletta. He goes on to win re-election as mayor in the biggest landslide in city history. I like to reference that he won the Republican vote by something like 90%. And then he won the Democratic primary as a write-in in his mayoral re-election. He tried a couple of times and failed, but eventually unseats Paul Kanjorski to become the representative. And now here he is running for Senate. And so this anti-immigrant stance, it propelled him, but it left Hazleton struggling. It left Hazleton divided. It left Hazleton with a lot of tension, a cloud that I think still hangs over the city more than a decade later. And it left Hazleton in debt. There's $1.4 million in legal fees that the city of Hazleton is going to have to pay to cover the cost of the challenge of this Illegal Immigration Relief Act that he spearheaded in 2006. A law that goes on to be unconstitutional, but nevertheless, they stuck to it. And now the taxpayers of Hazleton are going to have to foot that bill.
So, here we are with, Congressman Barletta running for, the United States Senate in really a primary field that's sort of weak and benefits his run, with, you know, Representative Rick Saccone, who is a Western Pennsylvania Democrat, sort of a backbencher, doesn't really do much out in the House. There's Jim Christiana, who wants to run, and he's really young. It's probably just to get his name out there for name recognition. I mean, this is really setting up Barletta for a nomination and a run against Brady or Bob Casey here. But one of the things that the activists have been doing lately, there's a couple of things that they've been doing. One of them is to try to get him to get off of or to remove himself from FAIR, which is a far right wing immigration group. What is FAIR and what type of policies do they approach? I know, like here in Pennsylvania, State Representative Daryl Metcalf has brought people in from FAIR a number of times to work on the immigration laws that he has been working on and to stop the quote unquote illegal invasion of undocumented immigrants into the state. What are some of the policies that FAIR has been championing?
Yeah, you know, FAIR is a really interesting organization because it's one of these groups, I think, that it really symbolizes the sort of shift we've seen in American politics, where a lot of groups that had previously been on the fringe now find themselves in the mainstream. So FAIR, I don't know off the top of my head the year they were founded, but FAIR has been around for a few decades now. I think 1979 it is. And FAIR is founded by a guy named John Tanton who came to found FAIR with an approach that I think you can only describe as eugenicist. Tanton has been documented several times talking about things like population control, talking about who should be having children and who should not. He was quoted specifically as saying, "I've come to the point of view that for European American society and culture to persist, requires a European American majority and a clear one at that. So this is FAIR's origins. You know, they've got this eugenicist past. They talk about undocumented immigration, but they're really a group that wants to limit immigration, period. You know, something that looks more like the RAISE Act that Trump was championing recently. Something that looks much more like that and less like some sort of deal brokered with comprehensive immigration reform. So FAIR has these radical roots, and the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified them as a hate group, as a nativist extremist group. FAIR, of course, denies that label and does everything it can to look legit, to look mainstream. And it has been successful at that. Members of FAIR testify in front of Congress. They're writing op-eds to papers. They sort of look acceptable, but underneath the surface, there's all of this ugly stuff that FAIR has done. And it almost, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
I know it almost sounds like what you're describing is the modern alt-right or the modern white nationalist movement that we're seeing cropping up these days.
Very much. I mean, so this is like the other people with ties to FAIR that are you know, prominent at the moment. Kellyanne Conway, Jeff Sessions, Chris Kobach, who's doing this stuff with voting. These are the kind of folks that have these ties. It's very much an alt-right kind of group that yes, has managed to kind of sneak its way into the mainstream. And it turns out that the Lou Barletta sits on the National Board of Advisors for FAIR. He is essentially a member of the organization. He provides advice to the organization. And so Anthracite Unite started this petition calling out Barletta on this and demanding that he resign from this position, that you know, on this premise that a congressman should not be serving in such a role. I mean, you know, and I think it makes sense. I think it should make sense across the political spectrum in that, you know, we can have debates about immigration, but when a group has this kind of history, it shouldn't be okay for a politician to be playing with them, right? To be playing ball with folks like this. It's just it really sends a bad message, and so it seems important, but he's refused. He's refused to step down, and in fact, his counter to the petition was that he's proud to be involved with a group like FAIR.
I know. Before we were talking, talking about the alt-right, and we were mentioning what happened in Charlottesville last month. I think this was before he announced his run. You said you were telling me that you wrote an op-ed or a series of op-eds, one with Penn Live or the Patriot News out here in central Pennsylvania, about Lou Barletta's refusal to acknowledge what happened in Charlottesville. I know it took him almost sort of days to even like put out a tweet or some sort of response on social media.
That's right. He did respond immediately, but his tweet was or his social media response was about as vague or possibly even vaguer than he didn't touch the racism. He didn't touch the bigotry that was displayed in those streets. In those streets of Charlottesville, he simply said, "My prayers are with the victims, their families, and the police and first responders who are working to keep the members of their community safe." So it's here, and it's with FAIR too, where we can see that Barletta is really trying to, you know, in my opinion, insult the intelligence of Pennsylvanians by kind of trying to create this base of people that aren't going to be thinking about racism and these sorts of things. Like, he's not even willing to touch it in a statement like that. There was pressure. So yes, I wrote this op-ed for Penn Live soon after it came out, and I'm aware of a lot of were orchestrating call-in campaigns to try to get him to say a bit more, and it worked. He released a statement soon after that that did call out what he called racial supremacy. The important point is of this statement, though, is even still he played the both sides kind of thing. He catered to this notion of false equivalency, where somehow Nazis are morally equivalent to people who are fighting against Nazis. So he talks about racial supremacy, leaving room for there to be, you know, not only white supremacy, which is problematic. And he I believe, called out Antifa as, or another group like that. I'm not sure exactly which one it was, but he called out one of those groups in his long list of sort of extreme groups like Nazis and KKK. And so, you know, he's still sort of not taking that moral stand that I think it's so essential for politicians to take. And you know, like if we look back on the history we just talked about, this makes sense, right? I mean, the coal barons of from back in the day wanted to have, and they wanted the more established immigrants to be pointing their finger down at the more recent immigrants rather than coming together and fighting back. In Hazleton, it worked for him. Rather than having people, you know, pushing back against this corporate welfare policy of KOZ, or rather than having people demand better wages and better conditions in these warehouses and in this new meatpacking plant in Hazleton, rather than having people push back against that, he convinced them to blame illegal immigrants for the problem, in his words, illegal immigrants. And so, you know, he saw that this worked, and he's continuing to climb this ladder. And frankly, at this moment where this stuff is becoming more and more normalized, we're seeing him do this. And I like to remind folks that, you know, while Trump represents stalking, this is an ideology that's been around, that has sort of been creeping up. And you know, Lou Barlett is an example of someone who was doing this as far back as 2006. And
mm-hmm. And then so a couple weeks ago, President Trump announced that he was going to be rescinding DACA, Obama's DACA plans. And moving on to our last topic with DACA, Pennsylvania Make the Road PA, which has been doing a lot of excellent organizing up here in throughout the state, especially in the Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, and the Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Allentown, Reading areas of the Lehigh Valley and the northeastern part of the state. They were really helpful in organizing people getting out to everyone, all the congressional offices in the state. And here in Carlisle, close to like 21, 22 people showed up in Lou Barletta's office to voice their concerns over this. His staff, I would have to say, was extremely courteous and professional in listening to all of the people who showed up and allowed them to speak. But that really doesn't match what Lou Barletta actually said on this topic. I know you were saying that he released a statement on DACA, on supporting Trump's rescinding of the DACA decree.
He did, yeah. And the statement is, I take issue with it in two respects. The first one is the simpler one, where he criticizes DACA as a policy by claiming that President Obama illegally granted, I'm quoting here, claiming that President Obama, quote, illegally granted amnesty to hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants. He improperly created more competition for American workers and legal immigrants. Irony in him talking about President Obama overstepping his bounds when, one, Barletta was a supporter of Trump's Muslim ban, and two, when Barletta makes his career off of usurping his power as a local mayor or the city usurping its power to regulate immigration, right? That law was found to be unconstitutional, and so he's done this in the past, and yet is criticizing Obama for it, which, you know, if we think more about it, it's clearly a dog whistle here to say that Obama didn't have the power, but if he or Trump does it, it's a different story. So that's the first piece of it. But what's even more disturbing, I think, is that he pulled out some terms from the Southern strategy that Republicans started back at the heels of the civil rights movement. He talked about the forgotten American worker. He called the repeal of DACA a victory for the forgotten American worker and the illegal immigrants who followed the rule of law to become part of our nation is his quote. You know, there's something to this too. I mean, he's, again, in part right about economic decline, about American workers struggling. I mean, we know, for example, that productivity in the nation continues to go up while wages are stagnant, right? There's real economic problems here. And so he's right in that sense, and he's tapping into something there. But again, he's blaming the wrong people for this. He's picking an inappropriate enemy. He's saying that it's the fault of undocumented immigrants for undercutting wages, and that's why the forgotten American worker is suffering. In reality, it's the opposite. If we were to protect immigrants as workers, undocumented or not, we would have better working conditions for all of us. You can't undercut working people if all working people are being respected and paid fairly and protected on the job. And so, you know, he's got this narrative going that blame a vulnerable group, people who are more marginalized, and those who are profiting from who are putting from not paying the working class as much as they could or should. And so, yeah, same tactic again. And I think as he's campaigning for Senate, we're likely to see much more of this, much more of him pointing his finger at immigrants and not touching some of this ugly racism that we're seeing and trying to rile up the same base that Trump managed to rile up. And I think he's counting on being able to do that to win the Senate seat.
Mm-hmm. And then one last question for our interview. Do you believe that the political landscape of Pennsylvania has changed with the Trump's victory in the state and the reelection of Pat Toomey? Do you think that the conservatives, this state's becoming more of a red state or with this latest victory? Or do you think last year was maybe a blip on the radar?
I think it's still too hard to say. It does seem to be undergoing a shift. But I think we're going to know more about that in the next election or two. There still could be turnout issues there, right? There still could be, it could still be a question of who came out to vote and who didn't, and who was excited and who wasn't. But again, we'll see. And I think that makes this so, you know, we have two people identifying as political heavyweight sort of represent both of the movements that are happening. Well, maybe not the movements, but at least the party. I think we're going to learn a lot more from this. I think both sides are going to come out and really put a lot into this race. And I think we'll really see. I do think it's still too early to tell. And that's going to that race is going to answer a lot of questions for us.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate taking some time today and talking about Lou Barletta and the potential in the upcoming Senate race.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And that's it for our Out the Coup Extra with Jamie Lungazel. And we'll talk to you next time. Thank you very much.